Council members. Next item on the agenda is a briefing by council, and Mary Beth, I had to go look up the motion, and we just had a discussion. We'll have an offline discussion concerning yours and see what we want to do on that. Okay. Gene.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to give a brief caveat up front. I belong to Pete DeColis' group of PowerPoint-challenged individuals. And lawyers are particularly remiss, I think, in doing PowerPoints because they don't like to put anything in writing, particularly graphic kinds of writing. And, there's not going to be any animation or pictures in this. I haven't gotten that far in my training, although it would probably make it more interesting. But I've been asked by the council to give a brief overview of a couple of the rules of conduct aspects that council members are subject to, specifically on lobbying and conflicts of interest. Conflicts of interest is going to cover when council members should recuse themselves from voting on council actions. I think it's in your program as recusals, but it really falls under a broader category of conflicts of interest. The starting point for understanding lobbying conflicts of interest concerns is found in one of the federal fishing regulations applicable to the council. It's under a category called rules of conduct. And the overarching rule of conduct and the one that sort of establishes the scope and context for council members is this one. Council members as federal office holders, and that's an important point, and council employees are subject to most federal criminal statutes covering bribery, conflict of interest, disclosure of confidential information, and lobbying with appropriated funds. So there are more specific details on rules of conduct in this section of the federal regulations, but this is the overarching one that establishes the context for it. So let's start by looking at lobbying activities and restrictions on lobbying by the council members. This has come up a few times in recent discussions conducted by the council. So let's define the term lobbying. Generally, lobbying is defined as any kind of attempt to influence government decision-making in the legislative or executive branches. And there are two basic kinds of lobbying that are covered by federal law. One is direct lobbying, which involves actual contacts between a person and a legislature, legislators, or a staff of a legislator, or other government officials, whether it's done in person or through written or other types of oral communication. And the other type is called indirect or grassroots lobbying. This is where a person would encourage others to adopt and support and advocate changes to legislation or policies. So somebody who would be going out to various fishing groups, for example, and encouraging them to support a particular change to the Madison-Stevens Act. And you'll note that these definitions are not tied to whether you're lobbying for money or not. It's exerting influence of any type, whether it's for money or whether it's to influence positions or changes to policy or to law. Now, to understand how lobbying restrictions apply to the council and council members, I think it's crucial to understand how these lobbying restrictions are established in the federal law. They're established in terms of federal cost principles applicable to federal grantees. I'm talking about grantees because that is what happens with the council. The federal regional fishery management councils are given federal grants by the Department of Commerce. And along with these federal grants come cost principles, accounting principles for how these costs can be expended. And there are various OMB circulars, there's various regulations that describe and limit the spending of these federal grants. And we're talking specifically here, of course, about the federal grant to the Fishery Management Council, which is considered a nonprofit organization under federal laws and policies. The general principles involving limits on how funds are expended with respect to lobbying are found in 2 CFR Part 230, and they generally prohibit the use of funds to influence, as stated here, federal, state, local elections, and federal and state legislation by direct contact or by publicity or propaganda. Publicity and propaganda are really synonyms for this indirect grassroots lobbying that I described earlier. So the council must account for whether it expended funds for lobbying, and if so, that could possibly be result in a disallowance of that particular expenditure. The federal fishing regulations applicable to councils specifies two types of lobbying restrictions. The first is one that's actually defined in a specific statute, and it says that the use of federal funds for lobbying the executive or legislative branches of the federal government in connection with the award of such funds is prohibited. So the council is not permitted to actually go and lobby for additional funds to carry out its activities using the council funds to do that. And a violation of this provision can actually result in criminal and civil penalties. The second type of restrictions specifically applicable to councils that are specified in the regulations state that council funds cannot be used to influence the introduction of federal or state legislation, nor can they be used to influence enactment or modification of any pending legislation by doing any of the things that are specified here. And this includes direct and indirect lobbying activities. Now, there are a couple of exceptions that apply to what otherwise would be a lobbying activity in the use of council funds. The first is the one basically that applies to responding to a congressional request to explain how funds are used or what funds are needed, or to this kind of otherwise lobbying activity can be permitted when the council is providing a technical and factual presentation directly related to the performance of a grant through hearing testimony, statements, or letters to Congress if made in response to a documented request. So if the council is requested to specify what it needs in terms of funding, it would not be in violation of these lobbying restrictions that I went through. The other exception are costs associating with lobbying to influence state legislation in order to reduce the cost or to avoid material impairment of the organization's authority to perform the grant. Now, this is one I don't know if we've ever used before, although I think we have written letters to states to at least notify them of actions that they might want to take to be consistent with federal actions. But this exception would apply, an example, I think, where a state decided to regulate its own state permit holders in federal waters in a way that's inconsistent with the federal management scheme. If a state is looking at legislation to allow this, then the council would be permitted to expend its grant funds to lobby the state legislation with respect to that potential restriction on the council's legal authority to operate under the Madison-Stevens Act. I've been asked a couple of times, so what happens if the council engages or a council member engages in lobbying activities by using council funds? And this is kind of a murky area, actually. We've asked the Department of Commerce, which oversees the use of grant funds, as to what it might do in that kind of a situation. And they provided us with a little bit of guidance. They've said that the council would be required, if there's a concern that the council has expended unallowed funds for lobbying, the council would have to provide an estimate of the cost incurred in any use of non-allowed lobbying activities to determine the level of cost disallowance on the award. Now, they didn't get into what happens next after that, but it potentially could be some sort of requirement to reimburse, to make up for those costs by reimbursing the council for that, for the amount of the cost that was used for lobbying activities, or through some other remedy that would have to be determined on an ad hoc basis. The other thing that the Department of Commerce General Counsel told us is that the council would have to impose some sort of appropriate disciplinary measures against council staff who have misused award funds. Again, this is a little murky, a little awkward to understand. If the council as a body, for example, requested that the executive director or a staff member of the council to write a letter provide lobbying to the legislature, and the staff member did it at the direction of the council, then technically I guess the staff member is in violation of the restrictions on lobbying in that case, and to the extent necessary, that staff member I guess would have to would be subject to disciplinary measures. I'm not saying they'd have to suffer any. We're getting into hypotheticals that I don't think any council has ever gotten into, but I know the council wanted to sort of explore what possible results could happen in these kinds of situations. And I'm very certain that the NIMPS and NOAA, Department of Commerce, would be very flexible and understanding the first time that this kind of thing happens, particularly if it was done without a clear intent to violate lobbying restrictions. Another possible remedy, which I have to mention, which again I think would not likely be implemented, at least unless there's some evidence of willful violation, is that violating these lobbying restrictions is technically a violation of federal regulations, which puts the violation into the category of a violation of administrative law with the possibility of civil penalties being imposed. Now, all of these restrictions on lobbying apply to the use of council funds for lobbying. These restrictions do not affect any private lobbying activities on the part of council members in their personal capacity. You as council members are perfectly authorized and allowed under law to engage in any kind of lobbying activities that you want, with a narrow exception I'm going to discuss here, as long as there's no nexus to the funding of that activity by council funds. So you would be free to go to legislatures, to the federal government, to the executive branch, to anyone else to personally lobby for changes in the law or other types of influence on the government. The one narrow exception to the allowance of private lobbying is one that says that a council member may not represent an identified person or entity before a federal agency or court on a matter in which the member personally and substantially participated. Example of this would be where a council member, let's say, voted to approve a new FNP that established limited access restrictions on vessels in that particular fishery. And in order for a vessel to fish in the fishery, the vessel has to get a permit, and the permit is based on historical criteria and other criteria that the council has come up with. And let's say that particular vessel is denied a permit, and then the vessel hires a council member that participated in the approval of that limited access program to represent him or her before the National Marine Fisheries Service in trying to overturn the denial in an appeal process. That kind of activity is probably prohibited by this provision that's in the rules of conduct regulations. Now let's move from the lobbying activities to conflicts of interest. And again, the starting point for conflicts of interest is that council members, as federal office holders for the, you know, within the scope of their council duties, are subject to general federal laws concerning conflicts of interest. These are the same laws that apply to federal employees, full-time employees, as well as other types of federal office holders in the federal government. And the general rule is that a council member or a federal employee, a federal office holder, is prohibited from voting on any matters in which they have a financial interest. Now, that general rule does not apply in the limited exceptions that are provided for in the Madison-Stevens Act. The Madison-Stevens Act provides that the general prohibition against participating in matters in which a person has a financial interest do not apply under the terms specified in Section 302J of the Madison-Stevens Act and implementing regulations that are specified up here as well. Now, the basis for the exemptions from the conflict of interest rules that usually applies is done if the council member files an accurate and true financial disclosure of all of the financial interests that that member has related to fishing activities. Those are specified in more detail in the regulation that was cited in the previous slide. But the idea is that, by definition, council members have experience in, financial interest in, potentially knowledge about the fishing industry, and that's why they are appointed to serve on a council. And to totally deny council members that may have some financial interest in the fishing activity the opportunity to at least participate in deliberations, if not vote on council actions, would undermine the whole purpose of having experienced council members looking at potential fishing management measures. So given that intent of the Madison-Stevens Act, there is limited ability of council members to participate in deliberations about and to vote on actions that may have some direct or indirect effect on their financial interest. However, that exception has a limit. And the Madison Act specifically says that a council member must recuse him or herself on a vote on a council decision that would have a significant and predictable effect on the financial interest described in the financial disclosure report. Now, these are statutory terms that are used, and I'm going to try to parse through them a little bit here to give you a little idea in a very general way of what some of these terms means and when the recusal is required. A significant and predictable effect means, and this is again statutory language, a close causal link between the decision and an expected and substantially disproportionate benefit to the financial interest. Now we have to bore down even further to see how the agency is interpreting these terms. Expected and substantially disproportionate benefit, and this is again statutory language, means a quantifiable positive or negative impact, and note that it's not just positive impacts, but negative impacts as well, with regard to a matter likely to affect a fishery or sector. Sector is not referring to sectors per se as we use them, but in terms of a general characteristic of a fishery, in which the affected individual, that is the council member, has a significant interest. And significant interest is, as we bore down further into these terms, is defined in the regulations, and this is not in the statute, as having a greater than 10% interest in the total harvest of the fishery or sector of the fishery in question, or the marketing or processing of the total harvest of the fishery or sector of the fishery in question, or greater than 10% interest in a full or partial ownership of the vessels using the same gear type within the fishery or sector of the fishery in question. So if a council member falls under these definitions as to what is a significant impact, then depending on what the action is, that council member may be required to recuse himself from a vote. Now, let me bore down a little bit on some other definitions that are necessary to understand this. The statute, the regulations use the term council decision in defining when a recusal, a vote on a decision is in play here. Council decision we have interpreted to mean decisions to adopt an FMP amendment or other actions such as a framework or emergency action request. And it also applies to comments on a secretarial amendment, the final council comments. It does not include votes and actions taken in committee, however. So for the clear application of council decision is on the in terms of when a recusal is necessary is when a council is taking a final vote on an FMP, an amendment, or an action or other type of action that's described here. It's not as clear as to what happens when councils are taking preliminary votes on alternatives that are going to be included in an FMP or an amendment. Those kinds of calls would have to be determined, I think, on an ad hoc basis in consultation with me before a vote is taken and before a council member decides whether it's appropriate to vote on a particular matter that doesn't necessarily involve a final vote on a council decision. Now, to be clear, council members, even though they might be subject to recusing themselves from a vote, they're free to participate in the deliberations right up to the final vote and may even indicate which way the council member would vote. And there's a process for you recusing yourself as a council member so that you're given the full protection of deliberating and so forth without actually voting. To recuse oneself, the council member must announce to the council before the vote is taken an intent not to vote on the decision and identify the financial interests that would be affected. Now, what are the consequences if a council member violates the provisions on when they're supposed to recuse themselves from a vote? This is the regulation that speaks to that, and it speaks not only to whether you should recuse, but also speaks to failing to honestly declare your financial interest. So this section says it's unlawful for this regulation says it's unlawful for an affected individual to knowingly and willfully fail to disclose or to falsely disclose any financial interests as required by this section. And this next part gets to the recusal, or to knowingly vote on a council decision in violation of this section. And the penalties in addition are applicable to this are specified in this federal regulation. This is actually 50 CFR 600.735. In addition, a violation of either of these two things, the knowing willfully failing to disclose financial interests or voting on a matter in which the council member should have recused him or herself, can result in the removal of the affected individual from the council. Now, another type of conflict of interest that exists that goes beyond sort of the general voting on fishery management measures that might have a significant impact on financial interest is where there's a personal conflict of interest. Now, this provision is also provided under the rules of conduct regulations, and let me just read this. No council member may participate personally and substantially as a member through decision, approval, et cetera, in a particular matter primarily of individual concern, such as a contract in which he or she has a financial interest, even if the interest has been disclosed in accordance with 600.235. Violation of this provision may result in removal of the affected individual from the council. Now, this gets beyond the exception and the intent for the exception for voting and participating in discussions on general fishery matters. This refers to situations, for example, where a council member may be seeking a contract to do a research paper for the council, and the council member be paid for that research paper. If the council, at the time the council takes up the matter for deciding whether that council member should be granted this contract, the council member in question not only would not be able to vote on whether to grant the contract to him or herself, but could not participate in the deliberation about it. So this prohibition is in play when the matter before the council is primarily going to affect, or is specifically going to affect, the individual financial interest of a council member and really no one else. That it's a matter that is so particular to that council member that no other person is affected. So we haven't had too many of those situations arise either, but it's one to be aware of, to fully flesh out the prohibitions that exist here. So that is a fairly quick summary of these two concepts, and I'm open for questions here if there are any. Paul.
Gene, could you try to get that slide back about council members holding a federal office so I could see that real
slide
quick?
Slide 2.
Slide 2. Federal funds for lobbying.
General rules of
okay, council members as federal office holders. Is a council member a federal office holder only when he's being paid? For instance, at this meeting, a council member is a federal office holder. But at the end of this meeting, when he goes or she goes home on Friday and is not getting paid and is not doing business, are they a federal office holder?
I think it would depend on what activity you're looking at to see whether it's appropriate or not. For example, if a council member next week decides to use council funds somehow, either maybe through copying or having staff time write them a letter or something in order to present to a legislator, then even though the council member may not be getting paid at that time, they'd still be in violation of the lobbying restriction because they're using council funds in order to conduct a lobbying activity. So it's a very kind of complicated, nuanced area as to when a council member is a federal employee or federal office holder and when they're not. Certainly when they're at the council meeting, you have the strongest argument that they're acting in that way.
I have John Quinn and then John Bullard.
Thank you very much. Two questions. One on the lobbying. I don't know, at the state and federal level, there's a cooling off period that kicks in when you leave or on it, whether that is part of the policy. I didn't see that up there, but I just wanted to raise that issue. And then the second question I'll ask at the same time, and just kind of in practical terms, I call up my local congressman and say, I think you ought to pass XYZ bill, and it part of that bill includes increased funding for the council. Is that a violation?
I think not. I'll answer the second part of your question. If you're doing that strictly in your personal capacity, without using any way council funds for that lobbying activity, I think you are permitted to do that. And in response to your first question, there's nothing in the federal fish regulations that addresses this cooling off period. That applies, I know, for federal employees. I don't think it applies to council members. I don't think there's anything specific on that, but I would have to go back and double-check to see if I'm missing something on that.
Otherwise, you'd be barred forever from doing anything.
Right. Well, federal employees are only barred for a certain amount of time in connection with matters that they specifically...
Right. No, I mean, a council member, then,
yeah.
that's a strict...
There may be a time period, but I don't think there is. Okay. I think they're not subject to those kinds of cooling off periods, but I'd want to double check that.
Okay.
And get back to you.
Okay. John Bullard.
Gene, thank you very much for the presentation. I've often thought that being a council member is a very difficult job, and anything we can do to make it less difficult is important. And the Magnuson Act has put in place this fundamental conflict, which is really the part of the beauty of the Magnuson Act. That is, we want in the Magnuson Act people involved in the fishery to be involved in management, right? So right from the beginning, there is this potential for conflict. And so I think that you can't remove it because that's really the essential part of the Magnuson Act. And I think that as you were talking about this, I'm wondering, how do you answer the question, when is a person a citizen and when is a person a councilman? And unlike as John asked, you know, it's not, there isn't a cooling off period because you go back and forth all the time from being citizen to being council member, citizen, council member. And so how can we make it clear? When you're a citizen, you have the ability to petition your government. And when you're a council member, there are restrictions. And this whole mess about FOIA? FOIA-ing. It's like saying quahog, right? I mean, jeepers. I'm wondering, one technological fix, I don't know if it's a legal fix, but we've talked about providing council members a separate email address that is a council email address. Doesn't cost any money, but it says when council members are doing council business, you use a council email address. And that's a simple demarcation that says, I am now acting as a council member. And when you're not acting as a council member, you use your personal email address. So it is a demarcation line. It probably has no legal significance, but it establishes a boundary that says, now I'm a council member, I'm writing an email that says I'm a council member. I'm acting as a council member. And I don't know who sets it up, but it really doesn't cost any money, I don't think. And it would establish a role that says, in this communication, I'm a council member. And when I'm not using it, I'm a private citizen. And I think the more things we can do that demark when you're a citizen with all the rights of citizenry, and when you're a council member and you are an office holder, I think the easier it is. Because, boy, if all of your emails are subject to FOIA, what a hornet's nest that is. And I hope we win that suit, but we shouldn't get into that to begin with. And if you can't petition your government, if you sign up to be a council member and all of a sudden you can't petition your government to do just what John Quinn said, that's a travesty. So whether it's email accounts or any other thing, we ought to make it easy for you to change your role as often as need be, to go from being a council member to being a private citizen, because that is what the Magnuson Act is based on from the word go.
Yeah, I mean, we are struggling with that right now in connection with a particular FOIA, because we've taken the position, NOAA has, that Council member private emails are not subject to FOIA, are not part of the administrative record for a decision that the council may have taken. But there's pushback from various sides on that interpretation. And one of the ways that we thought, or other people have put forward to address this problem is exactly along the lines that John just mentioned. Of course, it's a two-edged sword. You know, you have the devil's in the detail in defining what is council business, when do you have to do it, what are the consequences if you don't put something in a council email that you put in a private email. So there's all kinds of devil in the detail kinds of problems that can come up. But, you know, I take John's point. I think it's important to be able to know when you can clearly act as a private citizen versus as a council member. And one of my intentions in this presentation is to clearly put forth that you can act in lobbying activities as a private citizen as long as you're not using directly or indirectly any council grant funds that are involved. And I failed to add to that, and you shouldn't be saying in your lobbying activities that you're representing the council either. You can say that, you know, you're a member of the council and here's your personal private thoughts, but unless the council's authorized you to represent them before a legislature or a government body, you should not be saying that you're representing the council's position or have authority to speak for the council.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just thought it sort of not bigger picture, the mechanics of recusing yourself and when and how somebody would do it. And as Gene goes through the steps of when you need to do it and how one decides if they exceed the 10%, it does get very complicated very quickly. So when you use Herring as an example, you know, you can define it. Do you exceed the 10% level by gear type? So if we have two vessels operating in the midwater trawl fishery, you can't look at the total removals of those vessels from the total landed fish. You have to consider how much was landed by that particular gear type. And then in a particular year, if you use two different gear types, I haven't even gotten that far. I mean, it's possible that I might have to look at that at some point. But so, you know, as you go down and get into the weeds of it, it's surprising how things could pan out one way or the other. The one thing about it, Gene, if you could go back to the slide that starts with, I don't know what number it is, but council decision, and then the last bullet, to recuse oneself, the council member must announce to the council that one. I think it's this one here. So from my perspective, the mechanics of actually doing this have been awkward. And I think that when we get to final action on a framework, an amendment, I mean, the list that's here, I hadn't considered comments on a secretarial action. I'm not sure when we've ever done that I would be concerned by that. But the emergency action, at the last minute, I was like, oh, my goodness, that should, you know, I should recuse myself on that and did. But the last bullet, it says you must announce your intent to do this before the vote. So I would just appreciate, as someone who does need to recuse themselves, if we could incorporate into our process the chairman asking the question prior to any final vote if anyone's going to recuse themselves. In that way, it would give that affected member the opportunity to announce to the council that, yes, I will be recusing myself, and this is why. We're not, like, we just don't, haven't incorporated that on a regular basis, and so it's quite easy if you're, like, not paying attention or someone doesn't see your hand, that it's hard to get that done. And so I think it would just be helpful as a matter of course if we were to do that. It gives that council member the ability to easily comply. And when you look at all of our decisions over the course of a year, we don't really have that many that meet the criteria for final action. So that would be my suggestion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm making notes on the agenda where there are final actions to ask that question. David Pierce.
Yeah, thank you, Gene, for a very good presentation, very helpful. I believe you said that a council member must recuse himself or herself if there's a greater than 10% interest in the total harvest of a fishery. So that raises a question of what defines interest and what defines fishery. Anyways, with that said, and with everything that you've provided for guidance right now, how would you tomorrow or the day after advise council members who are in groundfish sectors, enrolled in groundfish sectors, or who have very substantial interest in the sea scallop fishery, how would you advise them to vote on the Georges Bank yellowtail flounder allocation between ground fishermen and sea scallopers?
You mean whether that's a vote that is subject to recusal? Is that what you're, I mean, you're not
yes.
asking
yes,
to vote yes.
yes
or no on it. You're
right. Well, it's let's assume it's a final decision. It's not going to be, I don't think, but let's assume it's a final decision. How would you advise them to proceed?
Well, if again, I in the few times that I've let me say up front, by the way, that there's a lot more in these regulations about recusing and the details of it than I presented here. It gets very cumbersome to go through the details. And no general counsel representative at the council meeting is designated as a federal fishery official that is supposed to decide whether a council member should recuse himself or herself or not after being presented the facts and so forth from that council member. And so I would, you know, as a preliminary matter, you should always consult with me before deciding on whether to do it and how to do this recusal. Don't just decide on your own in a given circumstance, but inform me first so that we can get all the details worked out and try to verify whether you are actually subject to the requirement to recuse or not. I mean, if, again, I ask the council member that comes to me basically to look at this criteria and say, would this decision, does it result, I mean, first of all, do you qualify as a person having significant interest under this 10% rule? And if you do, is the action one that is, you know, meets these criteria of all of this sort of bureaucratic language that it's that you're, there would be a disproportionate benefit, negative or positive, likely to affect the fishery or sector of the fishery in a significant way? And is it quantifiably positive or negative impact? So you'd have to look at all of those. And if it fits that criteria, then that is something that a person who has a significant interest should probably recuse themselves from. You know, allocation issues like this probably do fit that kind of positive or negative impact and even quantifiable impact. So that is something that might would likely result at least in a discussion with me as to whether the affected council member should recuse himself or herself.
And a related question specific to allocations. If a council member has, let's say, 12% of all of the Gulf of May winter flounder allocated to him or her. Okay? That's one stock. Would that person be over the 10% for total harvest in the fishery? I'm trying to make the distinction between allocation of a particular stock with a catch share management. They have 12% of one particular stock. Is that the fishery, or would it be 10% of all of the catch, all the groundfish catch that that person would be taking in the groundfish fishery, all stocks combined?
Well, you know, I'm reluctant to just answer these on the fly off the top of my head. It does say total harvest of the fishery in question. Whether you bore down to, say, the particular stock, is that an individual fishery that's subject to this or not? I'm not prepared to give you a definitive answer on that. I would want to consult to see how big the scope of that particular species would be, and probably even consult with the DOC lawyers on how they would interpret this. But it's a possibility that it could be interpreted that way. I'm not ruling that out, but I'm not at the same time, I'm not saying that if that is the level of interest in a particular fishery that would necessarily fall under this requirement.
Thank you. Because this is relevant to future discussions on consolidation and excessive shares, and if indeed this council ever decides to revisit the allocation of groundfish that we have made through Amendment 16, it will become extremely relevant, I would suspect. So thank you for that very frank answer.
John Quinn.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to make an observation. I'm not looking for an answer, but, you know, I spent 18 years in the Massachusetts legislature, and by the time you get to the vote, the influence has been exerted. So I just find that ironic that the vote, by the time you vote, it's a done deal. It's leading up to it is when the influence. So not looking for an answer or comment, but just wanted to share that thought with you.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gene, you mentioned the obligation you have if a council member questions whether or not he or she should be voting. But what obligation do you have as NOAA General Counsel if a member of the public or another council member challenges someone else's right to vote? Do you have an obligation to do anything?
Yeah, let me... There's a provision in here that says at the request of an affected individual. Wait, no, that's not it. Any council member may file a written request to NOAA for review of a designated official's determination. That has to do with whether the council member must. Recuse a determination that a council member must recuse him or herself. Let me see. I might have to. I can't find the specific provision. I'll look for it. That I think does speak to this, Paul.
Doug Rout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a key detail that would be helpful for the council here, particularly the leadership at some point, is this definition of not just total harvest in the fishery, but sector in the fishery. What is the sector? Is it gear type? Is it if you land a certain 10% of a certain species? And to have that kind of guidance as to how... at what point these, within a sector of the fishery, these guidelines were applied to or these rules applied to would be very helpful. And my final question is this presentation in our briefing book? Because I couldn't find it, because I'd love to have a copy of this.
It was sent out a couple of days ago by Karen this morning? Okay, this morning. In your email. John Bullard.
To John Quinn's very good point, this conflict of interest rule that Gene has presented is quite liberal. There are many rules that would say that if you have a conflict, you... leave the room. You don't participate in debate, let alone vote. So this is quite liberal policy.
Dave Gazel.
Gene, my question is similar to David Pierce's, but different. I understand the 10%. Let's just say as an individual, I know I don't control 10% of the fishery. I don't represent anybody that controls 10% of the fishery. What happens if you're a member of a sector, the fishing sector, and that sector controls more than 10% of the fishery, even though you as an individual within that sector don't control 10% of the fishery? Is a sector an entity, or is it made up of individuals?
Well, there's a provision in here I didn't get into that states financial interest includes interest in which a council member may be an official or a trustee or some other type of position in which there could be a 10% interest involved in that particular group. So it would depend, again, on the individual circumstances as to what role the council member plays in the sector, and whether that particular sector, as used in the groundfish regulations, would have a 10% interest in the fishery.
Okay. Well,
so it is very, very likely that a council member who heads up a sector, for example, may need to recuse themselves if it meets these other requirements.
Okay, that is actually the question I'm asking, because, as an example, I've refused to be on the board of directors of my sector or have anything to do with it, just be a member for that reason, because I was afraid of some kind of conflict. But then again, my sector doesn't control 10% of the fishery either, so it falls under the other part. But I think we do need a clear explanation of that as to when people who are on boards of directors of sectors that control more than 10% of the fishery need to recuse themselves.
David Pierce.
Yeah, to follow up to David Gethel's point, a sector, a groundfish sector, is a person, according to NOAA General Counsel interpretation. So because the groundfish sector is a person, this relates to confidentiality issues, and I don't agree with this conclusion, but that's the way it's treated now. A groundfish sector is a person, therefore I'm losing. So the issue of whether a sector member, regardless of whether or not the sector member is on the board of directors, I think it becomes the question is, it's an unanswered question as far as I'm concerned, as long as the interpretation of a sector is that it is a person. So every individual in the sector loses their individual identity because they become one person. So could you address that, Gene, as to how you can reconcile that point you just made with what NOAA Fisheries currently considers a sector to be, a person?
Well, I'm not sure there's a conflict there. I mean, we consider a sector as a person for the purposes of the confidentiality provisions, the way that they're interpreted, not necessarily for all other legal purposes. But the question, as I got it, was would, for instance, a president of a sector that represents more than 10% of the harvest in a fishery, would that person be subject to recusal? It really doesn't have to do with whether the sector is a person or not. It has to do with the position of the council member with respect to that sector. So I don't think there's a conflict there at all, because the decision as to whether the council member needs to recuse himself or not is not based on whether the sector is a person or not, but rather on what the relationship is of that sector member to the sector and how much of the harvest that sector has in the fishery. And I can answer Paul's question if you want now. I found the provision. Paul had asked, you know, can someone raise a question of whether a council member should recuse themselves or whether there's a conflict there. And the regulations specifically say that during a council meeting, before a council vote, the designated official, that would be me, the NOAA General Counsel person, may initiate a determination of whether a council member should recuse himself or herself on the basis of, one, my knowledge of the fishery and the financial interest disclosed by a council member, that would be the information in the disclosure form, or two, written and signed information received within a reasonable time before a council meeting, or if the issue, that would be from anyone, or if the issue could not have been anticipated before the meeting, during a council meeting, before a council vote on the decision. Three, at the beginning of each council meeting or during a council meeting, at any time reliable and probative information is received. And four, if the designated official determines that the affected individual, that is the council member, may not vote, the individual may state for the record how he or she would, well, no, this is going into another aspect here. So basically, there's actually three things here. The designated official, in other words, the NOAA General Counsel representative's knowledge of the council member, any written information signed and given to me before a council meeting, or at the beginning of a council meeting if there's other reliable information that I get. In those situations, I would be forced to make a decision about whether the council member should recuse himself or not.
That clears it right up. Anyone else on this? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Gene, for that presentation. We will break for lunch. We'll do it for schedule for an hour and 15, so come back at 1:25. Strategic plan. I will turn it over to Bill Karp.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This item was originally on the agenda for the September meeting, but I was sick for the first day of the meeting, so we've postponed it. But we've also slowed down the whole process because part of what I want to do today, and I have been doing over the last several months, is soliciting input and feedback on the plan and on the implementation process, which I'm going to speak to. So the delay that we've had in my coming to present this to you and seek input will not in any way impede our ability to listen to and recognize feedback from the council. In fact, the Science Center's primary partners are the regional office, the two councils, and the commission. And so we view our interactions with each of those groups to be really critical. And the reason why we plan and set priorities is, to a large extent, to ensure that we meet the needs of these primary partners. So I'll talk to you just a little bit about process and what we're doing and why we're doing it, and then some of the specifics of the plan the draft plan that we have for the Northeast Center, the one that we're seeking input on. And as you can see, this strategic planning exercise is an exercise that's going on simultaneously at each of the six science centers and by the Headquarters Office of Science and Technology, excuse me, which is organized similarly to a science center, but is more headquarters oriented. The idea is to allow us to document and prioritize our science activities and evaluate places where there are synergies, places where there's need for consolidation, and to put us in a better position for dealing with the kind of budget challenges that we're already seeing and we expect to continue to see in the next several years. As I said, the importance of input from our key partners is really essential to this whole exercise. So this is a very, very simple schematic of the process where each of the science centers is drafting a plan, seeking input, and the plan itself is a rather high-level plan. It deals with very broad and overarching themes and foci for the science, but it's only part of the strategic planning process. Equally important is what we call the implementation process, and the implementation process is an annual process where we look at each of the activities that are going on at the Science Center and evaluate the performance and the conformance to the elements of the science plan. So each year we'll be looking at what we've done and what we plan to do in the next year. We'll be making decisions then on priorities relative to the broader goals laid out in the science plan itself. And as you can see, this just goes on an annual basis. The overarching plan is intended to be a five-year plan. It has some perspectives further into the future, but it's more specific in the five-year time horizon. Just a very little bit of background about the center itself. For those of you who aren't familiar with who we are and all of our pieces, we're surprisingly spread out. Even though the headquarters of the Northeast Center is in Woods Hole, we have staff at the University of Maine in R&O and all the way down to at the National Systematics Lab, which is actually within the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Our primary facilities, apart from Woods Hole, are at Narragansett, Rhode Island, Milford, Connecticut, and Sandy Hook, New Jersey. And Sandy Hook took a significant hit, actually, during the hurricane, and we're currently evaluating what is going to be necessary to bring it up to back into a good enough condition that staff can go back to work there, at the same time as working with staff who were affected by the hurricane itself. So we're very, very sympathetic, of course, with all of our colleagues in the industry, and we're seeing firsthand the impacts of this hurricane on our own staff and on our science as well. So when you look at trying to develop a strategic plan and think about change, you also think about the core activities, the things that we're doing on a day-to-day basis, which we need to continue to do to support the need to base the decision-making in fisheries management in this region on the best available science. And the core activities, and you'll see how those are defined in a minute, are really the things that we, regardless of what changes and regardless of the shrinkage of resources, are the things that we believe are essential to meeting that function. We also, of course, need to document what it is that we're doing, our capabilities, our collections, our capacity, and as I mentioned in the implementation process, that's to a large extent how that's going to be done. And in a broad and overarching sense, we want to move our science towards integrated ecosystem assessment. That doesn't mean we're going to stop doing stock-by-stock assessments in the near future. It means that we're going to be putting the pieces of our science together better so that we can develop a better sense of the ecosystems that we're working in, an integrated view of those systems, how they function, how they support the fish stocks that are important to us, and how they're changing. Because the whole concept of integrated ecosystem assessment, of course, is tied to the ability to really understand the impacts of change on the ecosystems that we're assessing and on the resources that inhabit those ecosystems. This is just a little bit more detail on the core activities that I mentioned on the preceding page, and really does speak to the importance of us maintaining the sampling, the surveys, the data collections that support the assessments, and the analyses that support the advice that we're providing to our partners inside and outside the federal government and the council system. I mentioned a little bit ago that I used the term themes and foci, and that's the terminology that we're using in these plans. So the overarching elements of the plan, if you will, we're calling themes. And so we've laid out four very general research themes, and then for each of those themes, we have foci. We have areas of specialization, if you will, within those themes that we're organizing our thinking around and that we're linking our scientific programs to. And I'm not going to read all of the text for each of these themes, but they do address the data collection and assessment issues that I mentioned before, the importance of moving towards a more integrated view and integrated assessment of ecosystems, understanding change, mitigating the effects of change on the ecosystems, the communities, and the economies, because the social sciences part of this is also integral. The third theme is very habitat-focused, and we had actually some considerable discussion about the wisdom of separating habitat from the broader ecosystem focus, which is better articulated perhaps in the preceding theme. But I think there's a lot of value to doing that, given the very important role of habitat in ensuring healthy marine ecosystems and stocks, and the consequences of change, the kinds of change that I was speaking to before, on habitat and our need to understand those changes and those consequences. The fourth one focuses on sustainable marine aquaculture. Our facility in Milford, Connecticut is very heavily focused on aquaculture, and so that is an essential part of the remit of the Science Center and is separated as a research theme for obvious reasons. One thing that I'd like to go back to that I should have mentioned earlier when I spoke to that circular diagram that described the process was not only am I concerned and interested in briefing and exchanging with our primary partners, the councils, the regional office, and the commission, but that the science itself is done through partnerships. And we're very much aware on a daily basis of the partners that we work with throughout this region. We find those partners in the industry, in the academic community, in other federal organizations. And one of the primary purposes of a strategic plan of this kind is really to fully understand how well we leverage our science with respect to the partnerships that we have and whether there are new opportunities for partnerships for building and improving the science that is so important to us. So I hope this isn't too small, but again, the idea here is just to give you a very general sense for the suite of foci of activities that in the draft of the plan we've organized under each of these main themes. And you can see that for the first one, the monitor, value, and assess theme, the foci really focus on the collection of data, the analysis of those data to support our primary partners, the importance of improving the assessment process and moving towards an integrated ecosystem approach. So all of those things are really tied into the under the general heading for this theme. The change theme, understand, forecast, and mitigate effects of environmental change on marine ecosystems, coastal communities, and economies. Here we just have three foci. Again, these are very self-explanatory, and really it's not necessary to read them to you. They should be pretty obvious. But the science includes monitoring to help us understand the anthropogenic impact or the impacts of anthropogenic and natural forces on the ecosystems and provides us with some mechanism for developing mitigation measures or approaches, the importance of forecasting change, which is self-evident, and one at the bottom here, which is actually related to the the aquaculture focus, the aquaculture theme, because it's a it has a broader impact in terms of it, in terms of its contribution to the sort of broader understanding of marine ecosystems and the ability to mitigate impacts, in particular the ability to mitigate. Here we talk about assessing the role of habitats, which I mentioned before as being very specifically called out, and why we've done that. The specific elements or foci here really do relate to assessing the importance of habitat to the various populations of animals that we're interested in, forecasting impacts of human activities, and feedback from this into the process of coastal planning, which is an emerging area where the center is being asked more and more to provide information and perspective. Fourth and last one is the one that focuses almost exclusively on aquaculture. And again, it's pretty self-explanatory. It describes the range of work that is going on at the facility in Milford and puts it into the context of developing the tools and technology, conducting research for aquacultural methodology, and looking at this interesting area of integrated multitrophic mariculture that is an emerging area that really seems to be one that is worth engaging in. So I'm hoping that this presentation, this brief presentation, will stimulate some discussion here at the council meeting, and certainly we'll be taking ideas from this discussion back to consider as we develop a new draft of the plan. But there's also broader opportunities for providing comments, suggestions, input. You can contact me directly through my email or by phone. And we've opened up the whole process so that we can solicit input from as many interested people as possible. Again, I'm hoping that from a presentation like this, council members, members of the audience, who are not yet ready to share thoughts but want to provide feedback, we'll think about this and we'll use this opportunity to provide us with a feedback through the website. And we'll keep that open till the end of December, perhaps even a little bit longer, depending on what the interest is. Also, if any of you have ideas for other mechanisms that we might use for outreach and other places that we might want to go to seek input, we have been in contact with many of our research partners, both in academia and in the federal sector. We've encouraged and received a number of very, very useful comments. So those will inform the new draft. The goal is to have a complete strategic plan done in the first quarter of calendar 2013, recognizing that it's a living document and it will be adapted and adjusted as time goes by, and for us to engage in this implementation process on an annual basis, which we will synchronize with the federal budget cycle. So with that, and with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to seek some feedback.
Thank you, Bill. John.
It's increasingly evident that part of my job description is straight man for Dr. Karp. I have a question, Bill, on, I don't know what slide number it is, but on the understand, forecast, mitigate effects of environmental change, including climate change. says forecast effects of environmental change on fish, invertebrate, marine mammals, sea turtles, species, human communities. The forecast part, I'm interested in the issue of past, once you forecast, the issue of communication. I think back to when Sam Rauch met with the executive committee of the council and in August, I think, and said, you know, he said there are clearly things going on out here that are, there's more going on than overfishing. And part of the disaster declaration are unknown causes. And he referred, I think he said, it may be climate change, but he said may be. And so you're talking here about forecasting effects of environmental change. And so it's an area that has concerned me as a non-scientist and what might be the impacts. As we talked earlier in the morning about yellowtail science, I mean, the questions about persistently bad recruitment and why are yellowtail undersized. I mean, we have more questions than we have answers. So you're saying here this is a priority to forecast effects of environmental change. And I know you've spent a lot of time thinking, and you're actually investing in communication. So once you know or you can forecast effects of environmental change, then how do we or how do you go about communicating what those effects are? And what's your role in that? What's the council's role in that? What's the regional office role in that? Once you get to the point of forecasting, then how do we go about communicating?
In 30 seconds or less?
it's
a big issue, and it's a big question, and I'm glad you asked it. You know, the process of forecasting, of course, is complex and ever-changing, and it includes hands-on research, such as the experimentation that you saw, John, that was taking place on ocean acidification at Sandy Hook before the hurricane hit, and which we will continue once we've managed to get things back up and running, and drawing from a huge breadth of the scientific community in the research that's going on to understand specific factors that are changing or are likely to change and how they may impact specific parts of the ecosystem. This is all put together through ecosystem modeling. And we have, and many other institutions have, very smart people and very powerful computers that are building these ecosystem models that are helping us both to characterize the systems that the current state of the systems that we're working in, and using the best available information to project how they might change under various different kinds of scenarios. Again, that's really an ongoing project. As we learn more, we get better at this, but there's no absolutes. And an essential element in all of this is uncertainty, and doing the best that we can through our science to reduce uncertainty, but never being able to remove it entirely. The question of what we do with the projections, we validate them, of course, through the peer review process, through interactions with the scientific community, which sort of hone the science, validate the work, and using these ecosystem models, it is possible then to develop projections of the condition of key elements of the ecosystem, of key fisheries, assemblages, whatever it is. And we want to be able to bring that forward in terms of advising, in terms of the scientific advice that we bring. You talked about yellowtail, and I think it's a really good illustrative example. This stock has failed to rebuild in spite of significant efforts to allow it to rebuild. The factors that affect the abundance of fish stocks include fishing, but also include the ecosystem. And as the ecosystem changes, then the extent to which those environmental factors impact the condition of the stocks and the viability also changes. The balance between the fishing activity and other environmental factors also changes. So part of the difficulty here is this forces us into a box of being more cautious because we're less certain about where things are going, and that makes it more difficult to give clear advice. It means the old models don't work as well as they did before. It means the historic data is less useful in terms of helping us to predict the future. So, but I think that there's an emerging view, and I subscribe to it as well, that we really only can develop a holistic view of how things are changing, or that we need to develop a holistic view of how things are changing to help us understand how those changes are really affecting the individual stocks that we're responsible for managing. And I don't know that I can give you any more specifics than that, but I think it's part of the discussion that we need to have in terms of developing our thinking along those lines.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Bill. I went to the website in September because this was originally on our agenda, and I was not able to find the strategic plan, and I've only spent about 2 minutes here now looking for it, and I'm still not sure how to get there. And the way you described it, it seemed like there was a means, if you went to the website, that you could actually provide comments directly in that way. So could you use a little help finding the plan on the website? And then my question to you was, what kind of feedback were you looking for? I think it would be difficult to go to any of the information that you provided and say, well, we don't want that. I mean, it all seems like, you know, all worthy things for the Science Center to be doing. And thinking about in terms of going forward, are we in a situation where we need to prioritize some of these activities, or just some feedback from you on what kind of feedback you would like from us?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mary Beth. I just looked, actually, at lunchtime, and it's not online, and we just need to take care of that. There's a problem with access, and we'll resolve that and then communicate that back out through the council and solve that problem. In terms of the kind of feedback, your point is well taken. This sort of overarching plan really, you can find a home for almost all of the science that we do in one way or another, or all of the science that people think it's important for us to do. Your point about priorities, I think, is important, and I spoke to that in describing the implementation process, where we are going to have to look at priorities and make some tough decisions with regards to what the portfolio of science that we continue to move forward. I think that in asking people to look at this plan online and provide feedback, we want to make sure that we really are not missing something important, or that the connections that are laid out in the plan are clear, so that in reading the plan you can understand what we're saying, where we're going, and that it makes sense to you. And if there's ways that you think that we can improve it along those lines, I think that's really what we want to hear.
Doug Grove.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Bill, for this overview. My question is, without having the strategic plan in here, where within the four research themes of the strategic plan do you provide information on where you want to have, what kind of role you want to have with your state partners in your strategic plan? There's parts of each one of these things that I can envision that the states can provide things to you and that you can provide things to me. Is that integrated someplace within the strategic plan?
Mr. Chairman, Doug, thank you for that comment. Actually, it's a very good point. I think you're right that you can see points of connection and places where we are engaged under each of the themes. And it may be that we want to think about some kind of a matrix which identifies some of the specifics and makes some of these linkages so that there's something a little bit more concrete in there to characterize really the nature of those connections and interactions.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Bill. This is very gratifying to see. On the slide entitled Four Research Themes, you made the decision, I think, quite appropriately to take habitats as a separate issue. I had a couple of comments on that that fit in with your decision to do that and a question. When you say to describe and assess the role of habitats, we've had a problem in defining what part of habitat we want to really deal with. And with the SASE model and in the habitat committee, we have dealt with the benthic habitat, the benthic structure. And we found that benthic structure, the important parts of it are about one-third geological and about two-thirds biological in the structure itself. But the other part of the habitat that we haven't dealt with, because there's been, to my knowledge, very little done on it, is the water column habitat. And I have never been able to get a grasp of what the relative importance of the habitat of the water column and obvious changes in water column would have to ensuring a healthy marine ecosystem. That's the first thing I'd like to ask you about. And just to finish it off, when you mention healthy marine ecosystems, we've never really come up with an adequate definition of that. And I would offer that we went through the same discussion when we first began the habitat amendment. What is it we're trying to produce? Are we trying to produce 1492 or you know, what exactly is it we're trying to do here? And I would offer that the best way to look at it is that we are looking for a fairly stable marine ecosystem which maximizes excess biomass productivity of species which are useful to Homo sapiens. And I think that by looking at it in that way, we can more adequately get a grip on just what it is we mean by a healthy marine ecosystem, because it's never going to be a constant, and it's always a moving target. So I think that we have to have a goal that recognizes the dynamic nature of it and stresses the fact that what we're trying to do is to maximize the excess biomass productivity, which is all we can really harvest in that way. And my question is, do you foresee anything being done on the structure of the water column and how that relates to the goal of maximizing excess biomass productivity?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, let me speak a little bit to your first comments and then try and get into the question that you asked. The water column issue and habitat is obviously a challenging one. And I'm thinking of this recent work that Kevin Friedland, who works for us, has done on thermal habitat and the relation between major zooplankton species and the thermal regime that they inhabit and the consequences of change in the thermal regime in Georgia's Bank. That's water column habitat. But it's only one dimension of water column habitat, of course. And clearly, animals that either inhabit the pelagic for their whole lives or for a portion of their lives are really dependent on features of that habitat. So it's an area that needs to be focused on more and better understood, particularly in these times of change. The question about what is healthy, what's your definition of an ecosystem which is performing in a way that we consider healthy? And I think the proposal that you put on the table has some merit. Another proposal that is emerging in Europe is one under what's called the Marine Strategy Framework Directive, where indicators of good environmental health have been developed for a number of features of the ecosystem, which include everything from contaminants to productivity of stocks that are harvested to other anthropogenic noise. There's 20 different categories, and what they've done there is they've developed indicators which are monitored, and those are used to determine conformance to good environmental health, at least in each of those areas. Now, for us, of course, we're not the EPA. We're not collectively looking at passing judgment on the broad condition of the ecosystem or some of the other anthropogenically impacted areas. But we still have to be thinking of things that way. You're going to have to repeat your question because I can't read my writing here.
Oh, Lordy, which one? But the question was on work that was being done on water columns, and you've thoroughly answered that. I did see the stuff on the thermal aspect of water columns, and I was also thinking of chemical and physical changes. But the idea of using indicators, that appeals to me. I like that. That's a good way to go.
Thank you.
Dave Gates.
Yeah, Bill, I have two questions. One is on the four research themes. The first one, it says monitor, value, and assess fish. Specifically, the word value, is it put an economic value on them? Is it value judgment? You know, this one's worth more than that. Could you define how you're going to define value?
Value is really an economic value, so it recognizes the role of our social science and economics group and where they think that they can contribute in this area.
Thank you. That's what I was hoping. The second one is on the issue of how humans interact with the ocean. I get this sense that most of the description here appears to be, I don't want to say negative, that doesn't come out quite right, but it's evaluating forecast impacts of human activities. And to me, it's an assumption that all human activities are negative. And I would submit that humans are part of the ecosystem, like it or not. And, you know, we have to account for this. And therefore, I think what we need to say is something more, identify value judgments and trade-offs from human impacts. Because we are going to have to make, as a society, a number of value judgments and trade-offs in our ocean activities, just like we do in agriculture. I mean, you know, if we were to apply this same standard to agriculture, we go, oh, this is terrible. We plow up ecosystems and turn them into monoculture. But that's exactly what we have to do as a species in order to survive. So we're going to need to apply those same types of judgments to the ocean at some point, and I'd like you to comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Dave, I think your point is very well taken. I think it is sort of a natural instinct to put a negative spin on anthropogenic interactions, but it is also absolutely true that the integrated ecosystem approach considers humans an integral part of the ecosystem. So we are engaging in interacting with the ecosystem for whatever reasons, in whatever ways, and I think the language you're suggesting is probably a better way to characterize that.
Anyone else on the council? Dave?
Yeah, I meant to mention, I think that your ecosystem status reports are absolutely phenomenal. They're excellent pieces of work. I use them a lot in the things that I do, and I just wanted to commend you and your staff for the high quality of that work. In fact, I have the 2011 one right in front of me. Excellent piece of work.
Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Anybody have a comment, a question? Ellen?
Ellen Gaethel, fishing vessel Ellen Diane, and I would like to thank Dr. Karp for including the resilience of human. Wait a second. Resilient coastal communities and economies under the four research themes. It's the first time that I've seen the resilience of human communities in the scientific terminology, and I hope that it includes exactly what David had said, not only the resilience of the fishing industry, but of the coastal communities and the ability of humans to exist in a positive state with a healthy ocean. And I wanted to thank you because that's really important. Resilience has always been added to the natural environment, but we keep skipping the resilience of the human communities, and that's a really big piece. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Ted.
Ted Platts, Commercial Fisheries Center of Rhode Island. It's been interesting to listen to this, but you know, a lot of the thoughts and meanderings have been about ecosystem and habitat management considerations. And the reality is, as you develop that out, it's going to take quite a bit of time. You need to determine the accuracy and predictability of these systems. They need a lot more data points on the line before they're going to be particularly useful here to us at the New England Council in managing specific stocks. My question goes to the here and now. You know, what are we going to do to improve the problems that the fisheries management process faces with the Science Center historically, the center that you inherited, a center that was described as leaderless and visionless, which obviously calls for a fair amount of change, and a lot of us have been looking for that. I realize it's early in your tenure, and you know, we're looking and watching and waiting. The specific problems we face are the lack of frequency of assessment data and the lack of volume across the breadth of species. And the third problem is the speed at which this science, this assessment work, comes to the table. Now, the Executive Committee of the Commercial Fisheries Center met with our congressional delegation and with Dr. Merrick less than a year ago to discuss these problems and the problems we face with regard to fisheries science and fisheries management. And his comment was that we really need to be looking at a science model where we're doing an assessment on virtually every stock virtually every year. And he referred to a few longer-lived stocks that you might be able to go every other year, which is more or less a paraphrase of what he said. My question is, what is the Science Center doing to get us to where Dr. Merrick said we need to be to have effective science and therefore effective management? We can talk about nice, large, macro sort of ideas and modeling, but the reality is, at a nuts and bolts, here and now level, we need some real change in what the Science Center is delivering to the management process. We need more breadth, we need more depth, and we need more speed in the delivery. My question is, what are you doing at the Science Center to make that change happen?
Mr. Chairman, Ted, there are clearly some very significant challenges that we're facing, and it would not in any way be appropriate to ignore them. One of the points that I tried to articulate in presenting this plan was the need to, at a minimum, maintain the data collection and assessment activities that we have while advancing to develop the ecosystem context. So, of course, the intent is not to suddenly say, you know, we're not going to do this kind of stuff anymore. Everything's going to be done within an integrated ecosystem assessment. That's neither reasonable nor appropriate. I did also identify within the first theme a focus on improving, advancing, developing assessment methodology and data collection. And the concept that Dr. Merrick discussed with you, I believe, was one that was developed and presented to the NRCC, which is the Northeast Regional Coordinating Committee, a couple of years ago, which is under which all or most stocks would receive a routine operational assessment every year, which would be just really an update based on new data. And then for those stocks which were particularly problematic or where we had significant new information, then research will be focused on developing improved assessment methodology for those stocks. That proposal is still on the table. Frankly, when that proposal was brought forward, it was brought forward with a budget for staff and resources, which indicated that it would require significantly more staff in those areas than are available to us now. And that part of the equation, of course, was never satisfied. But let me speak nevertheless to the points that you made about breadth, depth, and timeliness or speed. The speed part is always going to be a problem. Part of it just has to do with, again, what can be handled by available staff in a reasonable period of time. Another part of it is the data. There's vast quantities of data that are necessary to support an assessment. Some of those come from surveys. Some of those come from the commercial fishery. A huge amount of time is spent in reviewing and addressing deficiencies in data that comes from a wide number of sources. And that is one of the key responsibilities of the Science Center. So we don't actually have control over where all that data comes from or who collects it, but we do have to put significant effort into resolving inconsistencies and other data quality problems, which frankly slows things down a great deal. The frequency, I guess I already spoke to just in terms of the plan and our ability to get there. The depth, which really has to do with the sophistication of the assessments and the extent to which we can improve our assessments relative to changes that are going on and that are being seen in those stocks. That's a huge challenge. Again, a good example of that is Georgia's Bank Yellowtail. There are changes going on in the ecosystem which are affecting the productivity of that stock. We need to understand what's going on in the ecosystem. We need that breadth and depth of science, which is actually what I'm talking about in developing this ecosystem approach, to really understand what factors are affecting the abundance and the recruitment and the distribution of those stocks so that we can incorporate that knowledge into improved assessments, even of single species.
If I could just follow up briefly, I appreciate your point on that, and I agree with you. Obviously, with the yellowtail flounder example, there are a lot of environmental factors, and it speaks to the need to get away from this term that we've inherited, overfishing and overfished, which hardly addresses the issue. You know, it's like global warming used to be the term for climate change. It's one narrow point in a much larger focus, and so I hear what you're saying there, and I get that. In our conversation on the phone not too long ago, we talked about ways to increase and augment the Science Center's ability to get work done through matching funds, say with RSAs for specific species or working with industry groups or other outside groups. Do you have any plans? Do you foresee any opportunity where the Science Center might be able to increase its capacity by working with outside entities to bring more science to the table? Historically, this hasn't worked particularly well, and I think it'd probably be safe to say that it has something to do with the old mentality at the Science Center, which I assume you are going to be changing. A lot of outside people were met harshly and critically when they came in. They were seen as critics rather than assisting a problem. I wonder if you have any thoughts about ways to increase the effectiveness of the current budget that you have through using outside sources.
Mr. Chairman, Ted, yeah, you and I discussed this at some length, and obviously it's an ongoing concern. I spoke a little bit earlier and at last week's science forum about the fact that we're just, one science institution that has some expertise in marine science and an assessment in this region. There are many others. And we have actually had quite strong relationships with certain investigators and certain institutions, but there's great opportunity to build those and strengthen those, and I think that that can really help. Similarly, our ability to engage better with the industry is very important. I think that the cooperative research program has had some noteworthy benefits and successes, but I also would like to see that program better focus in a strategic sense, and to have some improved ways of evaluating how the different projects that operate under cooperative research actually end up contributing to the assessment. And also the whole issue of how to better engage the industry and other stakeholders in the assessment process. The assessment process is designed to be open and available for people to engage in, but it's also mysterious and intimidating, and we need to do a lot more in terms of opening it up, improving education, and improving opportunities to engage in a realistic way. And for us to really understand the kinds of ideas and knowledge that the industry can bring and is bringing to the table, and how to integrate that.
Well, thanks for that. I think there's a lot of industry groups that would be glad to participate and cooperate with you and assist in that endeavor. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
John?
This is in response to Ted's comment. I think I wasn't at that meeting, of course, but I think it's, in my opinion, more likely that rather than go to a scenario of annual assessments and annual plans, that it would be more desirable and more likely that in every stock where it's possible, and it's not possible with or desirable with every stock, that we should have as a goal trying to get to a place where we are setting multi-year plans, three-year plans, and because that has benefits for the industry that can plan ahead, that has benefits for the council, that has benefits for the science center, but you can't do it when you're lurching from one crisis to the next, where a stock is, you know, bouncing along its historical bottom. You know, we have to get stocks up to health, and then we can get to a point where you can set specifications 3 years out and people can plan ahead. And I think that's more likely scenario than doing stock assessments, full stock assessments for every stock every year. Dr. Karp may want to disagree with that, but
back to the council.
Or he might not.
Any more comments on this? Tom?
Just to that last point, I don't agree that that's a realistic goal. And for all stocks, as you identified, in my view, for very many stocks at all, I think our science is a ways away from being able to do that. Every time we've set multi-year specifications, at least in groundfish, we've realized in retrospect we were wrong at the start, and we only got more wrong as we went along. And then 3-4 years later, we look back and just realize how disconnected those specifications often are from the reality in both directions. So I think we do need to move towards more towards something that we've discussed at the TMGC, which is the track model of annual specifications and updates for a large number, the great majority of the stocks that we manage.
Anyone else? Okay. I would urge all of the council members to take the time to go once the access is available to the website and look at the strategic plan and to give the Science Center some feedback on it. And thank you very much for that presentation, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Before we move on to the next item, I wanted to recognize Bob Beal, who is here for this afternoon, and congratulations on your new position as Executive Director at ASMFC. And thank you.
Just real quickly, thank you, Rip. I appreciate it. Looking forward to the challenges of the job, and there will be many. Paul's warned me about those for sure. But, no, I think the Commission and the New England Council have had a great relationship, and looking forward to continuing that, working through the states and this council.
Great. The next item is herring. It's a 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 herring.